Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to episode 58 of the Criterion Reflections podcast, in which we will discuss The Widow Couderc by the director Pierre Grenier de Fer. Probably not a household name by any standards. However, it does star Simone Signoret and Alain Delon. So there's your calling card right there if you want a little bit of accessibility. This is a film that has been on my queue for four or five months. Actually, yeah, probably less than that, because we're in August of 2019, and the Criterion Channel, I believe, debuted in April of 2019, so maybe just 4 or 5 months ago. And this is one of the films that I added to my queue on the very first day that the Criterion Channel announced its new lineup, because The Widow Couderc, a 1971 film from France, was part of their streaming-only lineup. And as a faithful podcaster of the films associated with Criterion from 1971, I simply had to enter The Widow Couderc into my podcasting queue. However, The Widow Couderc is not going to be there forever. It's not a permanent part of the Criterion collection. It's going to be expiring at the end of September, and so I figured, hey, we are nearing the end of August, just a week or so away. We better get this recording in there if we're going to give it the coverage that it deserves. And so I am joined today by Adam Spickerman. Adam, welcome to the podcast. Nice to have you on, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. I've been listening to your podcast for many years now, so it's exciting to be on here. I myself am a TV editor. I do a lot of game shows and competition-style shows. Just earlier this year, I did Beat Shazam, which is airing with Jamie Foxx on Fox this summer, to get in a little plug there. But that's kind of typical of a lot of the shows I do. I'm currently right now between shows, so it's a perfect time for me to have some time to record a podcast. So,
well, I appreciate you making the time for me on this. This is not a film or a title that has exactly beaten a path to my door as far as other guests are concerned, but I am very happy to cover it and glad that you've joined us. So it's definitely nice to know that you're in the game show business there. We've got some friends of the podcast who have done their share of exploration of that particular genre. So it's very cool to have you on. Do you have some prospects coming forward? Are you out there kind of in the market looking for the next show to get on board with?
I'm out there in the market constantly. It's just it's a matter of trying to string multiple shows together. I wound up, you know, working pretty much nonstop from January to, you know, August of this whole year. So I took a few weeks off. Our family had a little vacation, and then just haven't lined up the next one yet, but usually something will come along. So it's just a matter of keeping your nose to the grindstone, sniffing out some different leads, to mix a bunch of metaphors.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, maybe we got to connect you and John Lobinger. You know, you guys are on that kind of game show thing. So fantastic.
Yeah, well, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get the two of you on there as an episode, lineup one of these days. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Let me ask just a little bit about The Widow Couderc. This is a kind of a cinema of quality project of 1971, and it's not a film that I'd ever really heard much about, or a director I've heard much about. Obviously, the stars.
Me neither.
Yeah, Alain Delon and Simone Signoret have a very prominent place in the Criterion collection, as well as just in the kind of the overall kind of history of French cinema. Great performers. I would even put them in slightly different generations, and that's part of the intrigue of this particular film. But let me just ask you, before we get into introducing the movie itself, what is it that drew you to want to participate in this particular conversation?
Well, I'd never heard of the film either, and so that definitely piqued my interest, because I've found so many great discoveries from films I never heard of, from the Criterion Collection and Eclipse, and I thought, you put out a call, and I thought, well, I've never heard of that one. This would be, I've got to go check it out. This would be a good one to maybe talk to someone about, because sometimes those are the ones that are the most fun to talk about, but you know, you never know what you're going to actually find when it comes to these obscure little films that Criterion puts out in front of us from time to time.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what we have here. It's a little bit of a slice of what you might consider the conventional French cinema of the very early 1970s. You know, the new wave has pretty much peaked and crescendoed and is now kind of slowing to kind of a crawl. Jean-Luc Godard has been veering off into his overt political stuff. François Truffaut is making fairly conventional entertainments, and the French film industry soldiers on. And for me, one of the most fascinating aspects is just kind of seeing what was being presented to the sort of stock and trade French audiences of this time. And what we have here in The Widow of Kodairk is kind of I see it sort of as an exercise in nostalgia. It's certainly not without substance, but it's kind of a throwback movie.
I definitely got that.
Yeah.
I completely got the kind of nostalgic vibe of it. I think that it's very much got that like rural pastoral, like the film maker seems to be very invested in kind of a pre-war France that's kind of innocent. And I don't know how well he's necessarily pulling that off as a deeper, subtext to the rest of the movie, but there definitely seems to be a very invested approach in looking at France before the war.
You say France is in a sort of a form of innocence. I suppose that is definitely accurate, in that nobody at this point suspected the absolute travesty of what World War II would bring to this part of the world. And this is based in the Dijon area, sort of the Burgundy region of kind of eastern central France, not that far from the German and Swiss borders. So we're kind of far from the glamour and the nightlife of France, of Paris, and of the or of the Riviera. This is kind of in the kind of French flyover country, if you will. And and it's based on a novel by Georges Simenon, which I still have not read any of his books, but my friend Trevor Barrett has informed me that Simenon was incredibly prolific. So there were lots and lots and lots of sources that could have been and probably were adapted into films. So I don't know if The Widow of Kodairk ranks especially high up there in the Simenon catalog or not, but it is based on one of his novels. And it's about a woman who has not an officially, but has kind of by circumstances inherited a little bit of a homestead. She apparently was kind of a servant woman for a more provincial French family, but a woman who suffered some hardship. I mean, she had been raped and had actually conceived a child out of wedlock by the patriarch of the estate, and because of the circumstances of her servitude had kind of taken hold of at least one portion of the family estate, which is not a rich estate by any means, but they're kind of country folk, and she has a little bit of land and a house, and she's kind of staking her claim. And there's a couple of sort of in-law relatives across the canal from her who resent her station in life, but really can't do a lot about it except sort of cast evil glances at her across the little canal. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that along those lines, that's actually, I think, one of the most interesting things about the film and going into the title itself, which I think is also the title of the Simenon novel, is by referring to her as the Widow Kodairk. You know, she married the son of the old man in the film, Henri, and he's still alive. But since his son died and she's his son's spouse, she actually does not stand to inherit anything. So she's actually throughout the whole film in very kind of like a nebulous state, which is partially why I think her in-laws across the way are so angry at her, because she technically has no right to still be there beyond anything. She's just kind of persisting, almost like a squatter's rights sort of situation, mostly because of the good graces of Henri. So her status as the widow Kudurk is actually very much tied up in the whole subplot about the property interest and the inheritance aspect of the story.
Right, right. So she is a bit of a, not an imposter, but yeah, a usurper perhaps is the word. You know, she's yeah. taking claim by force of will and personality. Simone Signoret, mm-hmm. of course, is a very bold presence. I mean, and she had yes. been for all the years of her her kind of domination in her own way of French cinema, a very, very powerful presence. Mm-hmm. And she projects that very well here. Of course, she's aging at this point. She's probably best known as a star of the 50s and 60s, but here she is in the early 70s alongside Alain Delon, who of course was one of the absolute golden boys of French cinema. And he himself is showing a bit of maturity. He's coming off of Army of Shadows, and of course this is after his other collaborations with Melville, like Le Samurai and whatnot. And here he is doing another film. Basically, yeah, this is Alain Delon, the movie star. Actually, both of them are movie stars mm-hmm. at this point, and cast into these roles of Delon in this case is kind of a drifter, a wandering enigma who just kind of strolls into town, and by virtue of a favor that he provides to the widow Kudurk, lifting a very heavy burden, an incubator that she's purchased and is bringing back to her home on a bus. He's basically just strolling down the road. We find out later on he's an escapee from a prison, kind of a bit of a runaway there. And perhaps mm-hmm. those clues are already obvious. Anybody who's kind of going to pay attention is like, why would this guy just be walking down the road and willing to, shack up with the first person who's offering him a warm bed and a meal to stay in, right? Mm-hmm. He has nowhere else to go, so there must be some kind of shadows hanging over his head. And that's basically the setup. This mysterious stranger comes into town. Mm-hmm. He's young. He's virile. He's definitely a very handsome figure. I don't think he's quite as glamorous as you see Alain Delon in films like The Leopard or Purple Noon or whatever, but, he still cuts a pretty sharp figure and gets the attention of these rustic homespun folk who don't see a lot of strangers of his caliber just strolling mm-hmm. in and out of town every day. And so there's a bit of this scandal that's attached to this whole situation. And I thought, maybe for this episode we should perhaps divide it a little bit into kind of an introduction, because I figure some of our listeners may not have yet watched this movie, so I don't want to get too deep into the plot, but maybe at some point we can declare the spoiler zone and then get into some of the mm-hmm. dynamics of what happens at the end. So, yeah, I've kind of set up the basic framework. What else do you want to add to that, Adam, as far as what would entice people who haven't gotten around to watching this yet to give it a shot?
Well, I think the definite attraction for this film, at least, is the two performances, which are the strongest part of the film, particularly Simone Signoret. Her best scene is the scene where she details everything in her backstory that has happened to her, which is done in, a fairly long take, single take, where she's declaring her rights that, she's worked this farm and she's been, treated by this way and that throughout her life, and it belongs to her. It's just an incredible bit of a great soliloquy where she's just completely lights the film on fire right there about 15 minutes in. And then Delon is also excellent throughout the film, and it creates they're both of such equal caliber as movie stars, it gets that really good like chemistry that you sometimes get. So the attraction between them feels very sincere, even as there's subplots with Delon being interested in the younger daughter Felice from across the way as well. So
absolutely, there is a little bit of that erotic attraction there, and I would even say it's it's parlayed. I won't use the word exploited, but you know, Felice, she's a young, beautiful woman, probably in her late teens in real life. Her name is Ottavia Piccolo. And
I think
so,
she was about 22. I was looking her up on IMDb, but I think the film is trying to portray her as late teens, because if you look at the way she's dressed in like this jumper in a very pastel color, it seems like they're trying very much to code her as like still, even though she has a child, that she's a child herself. Yeah. One of the first times we see her in close up, she's literally in the crib with the baby, playing with the baby. So I think they're trying to set her up as extremely young, not just young. So.
Well, and I thought that was a fairly convincing portrayal, because she really did have me feeling like, yeah, this is a 16 to 18 year old girl.
16 year basically. Old, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought.
And it is interesting. I mean, I watched it with my wife a few weeks ago, and there's a scene where she's breastfeeding the baby with a very, you know, she's very slim, let's just say that. And my wife said, that is not a breastfeeding woman.
That's exactly what I thought. I have two daughters, and I thought, this doesn't scan. So just because from knowing from my wife, so
exactly. But it is certainly a very there's a lot of tension that's cast into that, because even though Alain Delon and Simone Signoret don't have scenes of, you know, sexual intimacy, I mean, there's one moment towards the end of the film where they're actually seen laying in bed together, but it's not really it's not played up.
The film is very coy about their relationship. It does a really awkward iris when they first go to bed together. That is a particularly bad piece of editing.
Those Irish shots in general felt very anachronistic to me, which is, I suppose, a bit of an homage to the older style of film. But to me, it just felt clunky. Like, you don't really need to do that.
It also is like, it's like the film is embarrassed about, you know, Alain Delon and Simone Signoret's like age difference. So like, let's stay away from showing any intimacy there. But of course, gets very into the close-ups of Delon with the teenage girl when they're showing.
Oh yeah.
There, it has a very, very different approach as to what it's going to visually privilege.
So, and the girl's reactions, kind of her ecstatic, you know, moaning and facial expressions and all of that is very much kind of a cheap toss out to the audience, it seems to me.
Yes,
I definitely feel like they just did not want to ask Ms. Signoret to go down to that level. I mean, she was kind of above all that. Mm-hmm. She's a bit older. She's put on a few pounds, all that, you know. So it's kind of like, and so those may be some of the knocks against the film, is that how it plays to a little bit of that middle brow bourgeois mentality. But you know, I'm okay with it. It's to me, the film sort of has its own reason for being, and it's not really out to, you know, break new ground or show that it's at the very cutting edge of innovation or, provocation. It's a film that's really made for the middle class audiences of its era. And apparently this film did actually pretty good business in France and in some of the other surrounding European countries. I don't think it got a big release in the USA. The New York Times review that I've got in the show notes was from 1974. So it took its time kind of rolling out. And I think that's perfectly fine. This is a film that would appeal to more of a specialized audience. It's not really trying to, you know, grab anybody by the collar and say, check this out. This is something you've never seen before. But I do appreciate also the atmospherics of the film, getting us into this kind of bucolic French countryside setting. And there are some political undertones as well. There's headlines at the very beginning of the film about the rise of nationalism, the kind of, I guess what you would call, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not overtly racist, but it's very provincial. It's very, kind of narrow-minded, I guess, is one way of putting it, mm-hmm. in terms of its suspicion of the outsiders. It's ethnocentric. It's you know, just definitely kind of a wary gaze towards anybody who doesn't fit in, and that would include Jews, gypsies, foreigners of whatever sort, the kind of folks who might have become collaborationists, you know, another 5-6 years later, mm-hmm. as the Nazis kind of rolled over the French border and took possession of this part of France. I mean,
agree. Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, I did get a very strong vibe that there was, they were trying to set up parallels between the resistance and the Vichy collaborators mm-hmm. throughout the film, especially with the way like Delon's character just kind of drifts in, and he seems to be kind of representative of the resistance. But then, there's at the very end of the film, there's a title card that kind of explains some of his backstory, and I'm not sure how well that actually matches up with what I'd been interpreting before then. There was one line in the film where like there's some of the French army, like reservists, I think, come out of the town and say something like, "Oh, who are we going after? Is it a Yugoslav? Is it a Jew?" And mm-hmm. I thought that was all kind of funny, but also like very like particular, like, you know, like invoking like Yugoslavia. And I was like, "Oh, that's interesting. Very, not something you necessarily would connect into the era, but probably very, particular there." So
yeah, probably, yeah,
maybe that's the reference to gypsies you were talking about. So,
well, and the idea that the kind of southeastern Europeans were a little bit more on the socialist / Marxist side of the equation, and mm-hmm. And these locals were almost kind of, you know, hyped up for a chance to kind of go after some of those folks. It's kind of what you see in some of the, you know, the right winger militia groups of today, kind of just almost mm-hmm. eager for a chance to go after some kind of, you know, minorities, whether those are, you know, immigrants from the southern border or Islamic terrorists or whatever the case. But there's this kind of this priming of, you know, looking for a kind of a big violent showdown, you know, to kind of, mm-hmm. you know, kind of demonstrate their strength and kind of act on some of those bigoted impulses that maybe have been motivating them. And so you're right, there is this kind of political subtext, and depending on how attuned you are for it, it might be easy to miss some of that and just kind of attribute the tensions to kind of just small-minded you know villagers gossip and just a general distrust of, you know, of the newcomers, you know, and as well as an envy of this woman who's, you know, at a station in life where, you know, she should not be harboring these handsome young runaways and apparently plying them for sexual favors, because that just seems a bit unseemly according to the conventional morality of the town. I love that scene at the ending where the women are all kind of doing their laundry out by the edge uh-huh. of the canal, and she's holding up the pants.
mm-hmm. And they're kind of like, she's holding them up almost like a trophy, bragging to the other women, and they're not quite scandalized, but they're not quite like, you know, grinning, leaning into the gossip idea of it. It's their reactions are very subdued, but you can definitely tell that she's decided to be very proud and clear to her community about like the fact that they're having a relationship. So,
well, and I think the widow herself is pretty much at this point an outcast. Like, she will never be part of the mainstream of this community. She's always going to have a little bit of a scandal attached to her name, and again, it's partly because she was a victim herself. You know,
the class critique that there is exactly. Subtle class critique embedded throughout the film, where, you know, she'd kind of married into this family, you know, trying to elevate herself because her mother was a cleaning lady. She was hired out as a servant. But because her husband predeceased, you know, her father-in-law, she stands to get nothing. So she's like a social climber who winds up with nothing. So she is still kind of an outcast, even though, you know, she should have been able to, you know, transition into the bourgeois respectable society, but she never has been able to do that. And that's, yeah, it's one of the more interesting things about the film is those little, they set up these binary oppositions of like the different classes of the, you know, the sister-in-law is like a little bit more bourgeois and she's much more rural and more, you know, I guess more like a working class, the widow is, and also setting up, I feel like, a binary between old and new throughout the whole film, both in the love triangle, so much that there is a love triangle, but also visually we see a lot like with the, you know, the sister-in-law is more modern. And then on the more rural side is, you know, the widow Kuderic, who's still, you know, mowing down grass for hay, you know, with a scythe, you know, doing things by hand, washing her clothes by hand, while you see the sister-in-law using an iron to, you know, do her laundry. So there's, you know, there's a lot of little interesting things going on there in that sort of respect.
Yeah, and I don't think she's ever going to fully be accepted. She will always be the outsider. She may make a friend or two, of course, you know, and this is maybe the point where we can say spoilers beware, because I think we can start picking apart some of the final developments. So yeah, if you haven't watched the film, this is probably a good time to cut it off and come back to us later. Okay, so going from that point then, what ends up happening, of course, is that neither the widow nor her lover end up surviving the story. They become victims of the you know, the provincialism and the bigotry and the just the kind of skeptical suspicion that kind of drives this little village. And and that's kind of where the film, you know, kind of takes us, as we recognize the kind of fatal course that both the Levine character, Alain Delon, we don't really learn his last name until pretty late in the film. He's basically on a trajectory of doom, and as it turns out, so is the widow Kuderic, because you know, her choices and her decision to harbor this man and persist in her relationship with him, despite his infidelity with the younger woman, and despite the misapprobation of the surrounding, you know, citizens of this community, she's kind of made up her mind of what she's about, what she values, and what she prioritizes. They have this brief idyllic dream of, you know, building the farm, you know, not only just holding on to what she's already claimed, but expanding it in this incubator, as pathetic and as you know, quotidian as it is, that's kind of their symbol. That's their kind of
it is
lifeline to moving toward the future. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is a particularly clunky bit of symbolism, the incubator, which they, you know, they keep coming back to it throughout the film, and every time I groan a little bit. It's just like, it's literally an incubator. So,
yeah. But it is a ticket to prosperity. Yes. If you just look at it from a purely commercial perspective, she can raise chickens. They have a market value. They can put a few more francs in her purse. And, and he's, of course, the guy who's going to help make this, you know, clunky old bit of technology actually work, because what she ends up buying isn't really all that functional. It's going to take a little bit of risk. She's going to have to invest some of her good eggs to make sure it actually works. And that may end up going to waste. And so those are the little things there. But, you know, he is a young virile man with a roving eye. He can't help but also, you know, turn his attentions towards this frisky young girl. You know, I guess she's one of the reviews I read called her a nymphomaniac. I think that's actually a pretty degrading tag to throw on her. She's not really
very accurate,
right? She's a young girl in the kind of a dead end situation. She is pretty, she is attractive, and she is, you know, she's in this village where she recognizes probably from a fairly early age, I'm one of the, you know, one of the prettier women in this very limited set. And who can exactly blame her for wanting to take some advantage of her natural gifts or attributes? So I don't think she's really set up as a kind of a pejorative type of character. She's just kind of a person who happens to be nearby and available. And as we said, she's kind of played out for some eye candy for the sake of the film and for the audience. I don't know, any other insights or aspects to her character or the role that she plays in this story?
I do think she does have a role in the doom that both the widow and Jean are destined to go towards, because you know, she, for all that, you know, she and Jean have their affair, she's also biddable by her parents. She sneaks in and steals his ID so that they can take that to the police. So she's aware at least that Jean's getting turned in, and then you know, she's so she plays a role there, but and she's
also part of the distraction, winds
up warning them. Yeah, and she winds up warning him at the very end, which prompts Jean to run outside, which is ultimately what leads him to be shot and the widow to be shot. Mm-hmm. So like, she does have some aspects there, like in terms of playing into that destiny. But I do think she is kind of written, you know, just to give Delon a younger love interest that will do the nude scenes that they want. And
yeah, you do wonder,
her character is really underdeveloped. You're wondering, like, you keep wanting to wonder if like there's more going on with her character, like, is, you know, just who is the father of this the baby that she has, and is she only interested in Delon because he's an outsider, and you know, because she really starts flirting with him after Delon breaks up a fight between her mother and the widow, and so is she attracted to that aggression? But like, there just isn't enough development of her character to really like you know, play with any of that, those interpretations. It's just kind of underwritten, which is a little disappointing. I was struck in the ending just how intensely disproportionate the police response is in terms of catching Delon, because they have, you know, huge trucks and men on horseback and, like, you know, armies of men throughout the fields all coming in to try to block him off, you know, and this elaborate helicopter shot trying to show everything that they're coming in to do to stop him. And it seems wildly out of step until you get to the very last of the film, where they freeze frame and give you a little couple words of explanatory text where he, what he had been in prison for, that he escaped from prison from, was 12 years before he had in court apparently killed two high dignitaries, is what it says. So if you think that he killed two aristocrats or, like, you know, politicians, whatever it was, it probably means he's like an anarchist of some sort, but also, like, that's why there's this huge disproportionate response, because they, you know, they're still mad at him.
Well, yeah, he's a diehard enemy of the state. I mean,
yes,
the government has a very strong investment in not only bringing this guy to justice, but to just, you know, just destroy him. The minute they have a lead, they're all over it. There is no escape. He is going to go down right here and now, you know? So, but you're right. That is kind of it could be seen as a bit of a critique of the film, in that, you know, it kind of pulls this little stunt at the last minute, literally the very last minute, because up until then you just think, well, even if you've surmised that he must be an escapee from prison, somebody maybe on a, you know, kind of on a death row, or at least a long term, a killer of some sort, you know, you don't think of him as likely to have pulled off that kind of an escapade or that kind of an astonishing, yeah, scandalous event. I mean, to shoot two aristocrats in court means, wow, there had to be some pretty serious lapses in security. And it's just the appalling nature of how badly the government was owned in that situation that, fuels their thirst for vengeance. Because you're right, when you first see, you know, you've got the French Foreign Legion has been recalled from Algeria or something to get this guy. You've got rank and file at all different directions. I mean, you figure in the process of gunning this guy down, they're probably going to shoot some of their own because of the crossfire, because they've got him surrounded from every single angle. And what do you think about that whole, the final scene felt a little bit played out for me, or overplayed, perhaps is a better way of putting it, in that we not only have him in the house surrounded, but then he makes this dramatic run for it. Runs all the way across these fields into the woods. There's a whole cat and mouse escape game, and so you've got all of that, and then he winds up right back where he started. Right. It's like, well, boy, that was a little elaborate. Yeah,
I had the same reaction, and in thinking about it, I think it's pretty clear to me, at least as an editor, that his whole run out in and then run back in part of the climax is entirely reshoots. I think if you look at it, especially when I went back and watched it a second time, the ending, it's pretty clear that the original setup was Felice comes over, warns him that they're there. He and the widow have a goodbye scene, and then he takes his gun, points it out the window, and when it's like, you know, the daylight, the sun's coming up, he fires, which starts all of the police just firing on him. He runs out and is killed, and she's killed, the end. And I think they shot that, they put it together, they looked at it, and they're like, it's just too little. Like, there's not enough going on here. It's too abrupt. It's too fast. You know, we have this long tracking shot illustrating everybody coming in, you know, and then he's totally surrounded, and then boom, he's just, you know, he runs out in a hail of bullets and he's killed, just like, you know, in Butch Cassidy. And I think they then went back and said, well, what can we do? We'll have, so now, even though we've just seen a shot of him entirely surrounded, he's running through a field. Like, they literally like show the wide of him, like the people coming in, closing in on the farmhouse. And then like the next shot is Jean running, and he's already out in a field somehow. Somehow he slipped through.
Yeah,
but when you look at all of the shots of him, of him out like running around, and he kills one cop one-on-one, like there's no continuity to any of the shots with him running outside and killing that cop, and all of the other shots that have the huge cast of extras. There's the only continuity is in those pieces I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So it seems like they went out and they reshot. They said, let's get one cop that'll appear out of the grass, and he'll have a conflict with him, and then he's turned around and he's running back into the farmhouse. It's a very, very confusing ending, and I really think they were trying to bulk it up, and they went out and added reshoots to it. So,
yeah, it kind of collapses under its own weight, I think.
Yes.
because here's the thing: if he really has any concern for the widow Koderek, the last thing you're going to do is run right back into her household, because you know you're doomed at that point.
And he runs in runs back in under a hail of bullets, and then he says right after that, like, you should go out there, like they're going to fire on the house.
Yeah, that's pretty goofy right there. Like the cops are going to give her a free pass because she's just an innocent female bystander or something. And then of course you do have a pretty epic Alain Delon death scene, which, you know, he also does a similar turn,
a bloodless death scene.
Well, it is bloodless, there's a French review. You have to translate the text into English to get it. But the French review calls it his goat kick, which I think is pretty awesome. the little kind of upturn that he does there to just not only make sure that he's a primed target, you know, arms extended, chest fully exposed, legs akimbo, but it's just it, and they freeze frame on it as well, so that you sort of see Delon in his full I ain't got no stuntman glory there, you know, kind of ready to go down. And he does a pretty good sprawling leap and then fall. He does hit the ground. You see him sort of turning over there and making it happen. So hats off to you, Alain Delon. You know, you did your own moves there, and that had to hurt a little bit when you made impact. But you're right. Yeah, he's then gunned down, and you know, there's no blood. It's just kind of like he's dead now. That's that. And moments later, there's Simone Signoret with her kind of glassy, steely stare there, and a little smear of blood behind her as she collapses and does her thing. So it's a exquisitely poignant, tragique French denouement, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that's pretty much where the story takes us. Yeah, so what's your basic assessment of the film? Is this something that we should really, you know, kind of get people to check out while they've still got the chance? Or is this, you know, take it or leave it type of territory for you?
Well, I don't think it's a particularly good film. It's kind of a middling melodrama. But I've always been curious, you know, with the extreme critiques that the French New Wave directors, your Godards and Truffauts and René and all of the rest, leveled at French cinema. I'm always curious to see, you know, these cinema du quality things, like what was it that got them so angry? So I think it's worth seeing that, if only to like contextualize, like, you know, this is not the French New Wave. This is the other side of the French New Wave, but
absolutely,
in many ways, this is the standard of like French cinema. It's I mean, it's very much like watching a TV movie from like the 80s or 90s, you know, here in the United States, because I think it's made it about that level, where it's, you know, better than you would maybe expect, but it's not, you know, extremely sophisticated in its, you know, in what it's doing. It's not a 400 blows. It's, you know, a standard melodrama with an overcooked ending and a really, really bad musical score, so.
Which you will hear excerpted in the episode here, both the front and the closing there. So. But you know, to speak very briefly of Pierre Grenier de Fer, he's the director. I think he came up. I think he might have worked with René Clément, another one of those cinema of quality French directors there, who did some pretty great work.
Yes, he did.
Also happened to be married to Annie Fratellini, who went on to become the wife of Pierre Etex. And he was her marriage to Pierre was her second marriage. So, you know, there's some interesting cross connections here. And if you just look at the Pierre Grenier de Fer filmography on Wikipedia, you're going to see a lot of pretty notable names. I was just kind of scrolling really quickly. Lino Ventura, Charles Aznavour, several films with Jean Gabin towards the end of his career. Jean-Louis Trintignant, Romy Schneider, Lino Ventura again, Ingrid Tulin. Very interesting to see her crossing over from the Bergman camp. And on and on. Philippe Noiret. And others. So he seems to have had a fairly distinguished career, again, churning out the quality films that kept the middle classes entertained. And I'm sure probably there are good stories, you know, that tell us about important aspects of French life and of culture. I doubt that this film will ever get a physical media release by the Criterion Collection.
I doubt that as well.
I'm very glad that we get a chance to watch it because it does. Just knowing the kind of the contextual environment that some of the more radical French and European films were still doing at this time allows us to appreciate the innovation and the boldness of those kind of more adventurous art house directors. So I felt this was it's fairly brief. I think it's less than an hour and a half, so it's not like it's asking a whole lot of you either. It would make a good TV movie, you know, with 10, 15, 20 minutes of ads thrown in there. It's a suitable night's entertainment. So, yeah.
Agreed.
So. Any final comments you have about this, Adam, before we wrap things up?
I think about the only thing I wanted to mention that I don't think we went over was the role of Henri, who is the kind of the elderly in his 80s, impotent patriarch of the whole clan going on there. And one thing I noticed in rewatching it is there are several scenes, especially early on, where he's knocking at the widow's door because he still lives with the widow, because they are still continuing a relationship. But as Delon has entered her life, she's rejecting Henri. And he's selectively mute. The first time you watch the film, you think, you agree with the widow and the in-laws that, like, Henri can't really hear very well and he doesn't really talk much. But the second time around, you realize there's a scene where Jean confesses to the widow to being an escaped criminal. She asked him if he's an escapee or if he was let out, and he's like, yes, I'm an escapee. And Henri is in the background sleeping, and just before he admits it, Delon looks at Henri, and the widow's like, oh, he can't hear you, you know, he's not paying attention. But he is. And so Henri leaves in the middle of the film to go across the canal and live with his in-laws, his daughter, and he ultimately is the one that gives them the information that Jean's an escaped criminal, which leads to Jean being arrested and the sister-in-law and Henri going to turn him into the officials. And so it's another one of those things. It's kind of there's a lot of plot involved in his character, but his character isn't very well developed, and it's kind of undercooked in terms of like his motivations and the various class and sexual tensions going on there. And it's just one more layer I don't think we really had a chance to unpack, but I don't think the film really tried to unpack it very much. It's just a plot development. It's a little unfortunate because it feels like there's, you know, in these four layers of like generations from Felice to John to the widow to Henri, like it could have played with a lot more of like the sexual tensions and everything else going on between the various generations. And it never really develops that. And I think there could have been a little more something interesting done with that. So,
yeah, you know, that idea of generational conflict kind of brings me to mind of Diamonds of the Night, a Criterion release from earlier this year, where we definitely have a very overt expression of the older generation hunting down the younger boys. Have you had a chance to see that film by any chance?
I love the Czech New Wave films.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought that was just so visually striking and just brilliantly edited. That the tracking shot that opens that film is just one of the most unbelievable things you'll ever see.
And such an audacious stunt for a first-time director, you know, first-time feature director at Maze. And the ambition of it is, and the execution is really quite remarkable. But I do think about those scenes where the old men are just basically hunting these boys down in the forest. I mean, it's very almost clobber you over the head. But I do like that aspect that you're bringing out here, is that you do have different generations of French culture, some who have survived the war, some maybe born just after it had, or maybe right towards the very end of it. In Felice's case, she probably would have been born in the late 19-teens to be of age at this point in the film. And I would imagine that's another probably powerful calling card for French audiences of the early 1970s that doesn't maybe quite connect with us. I mean, there's those little scenes of like I don't know what they were called, but the French equivalent of the Boy Scouts, you know, those boys kind of marching and singing an old song. I have to imagine there was a resonance there for those audiences of the original day that we can't quite connect with. But, you know, you just sort of sense, this is kind of a throwback, kind of like what a lot of us are going through.
Well, I think at the beginning you mentioned this is kind of set in French flyover country, and we get that. One thing I think the film does really well is kind of invoking that with throughout the film. They'll sprinkle in shots of like, oh, here's a train arriving, you know, across a culvert into the rural area, but it's just a train and a coal car. Like there's not even any passenger planes, or these shots of various barges drifting through, you know, the landscape. But, you know, one barge is drawn by a horse and another one is a pleasure yacht complete with a French poodle. And another one is an American, just gigantic American barge. And and so I think you see all, and even a plane doing a loop-de-loop, a biplane. So you see all these little technological physical, different, you know, separated modes of transportation, taking all these people through this countryside, but never interacting with it. And it's like you get one of those, probably, I feel like almost every reel, it almost feels like each reel starts with a shot of like a different piece of transit. And I don't think that's actually something they did, but you know, they're about like 10 minutes apart, mm-hmm. that you'll now, here's a shot of another shot of a barge. Here's a shot of a train. Here's your shot of your plane. And, I think it really is trying to set up that flyover country feel, and like just the throwback kind of like rural, like, you know, pre-modern development of this location, complete with the iconic bridge, maybe the most iconic visual of the movie is this bridge.
I love that
covers the canal that, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, and I think that's what the family's role is. Like, that's why they're bourgeois, is they have controlled that bridge that allows the canal traffic through, which means they're probably requiring, you know, people that are on the canal doing commerce to pay them tolls mm-hmm. every time they raise the bridge for them. And yeah. that's like the source of their wealth. But it's also anachronistic because, like, the, you know, there's now a big automobile road bridge built over the canal. And I think that's maybe something that's particular to the Simenet original, is like some of that, both those overlapping love triangles of the four different generations, and also like all of this, like, you know, the old and new clashing together in terms of a modernizing France. That's something I think may have been in the original text that didn't translate explicitly to the screen in a way we have the context to understand, but that for French audiences watching in the 70s, they were like, oh yeah, you know, this family is rich because they're running that bridge, but we never sure. get like confirmation that's like the source of their status. So
yeah, whether they're wealthy or not, they are certainly in a position of control, and that's important yep. as well. Mm-hmm. All right, well, last question for you. What do you think about the yellow subtitles?
Oh, they were rough. I had to pause it numerous times to read yeah. some of them. They and reminded really me of the bad old days. Yeah. So, because when I was in film school, you know, 15, 16 years ago, we saw lots of foreign films on 16mm and sometimes 35mm prints, and they often had yellow or white subtitles. And we saw Bicycle Thieves, and it was the second time I'd seen the film. And it was white on white subtitles on a pretty beat up print. And I would say I could yeah. maybe read like a third of the subtitles of the film throughout the entire film. And like that's about how I felt watching this with the yellow subtitles. They're so unreadable. I only got about a third of them the first time through. So,
yeah, hopefully body language and a little bit of elementary mm-hmm. lip reading gets you through it.
Yeah.
And a very skinny font, too. I mean, if you're going to use yellow, at least give me some blocky letters to kind of distinguish, because, yeah, some of it was really...
Or a drop really shadow or an outline to separate them. Yeah.
All right. Well, on that very technical note, let's wrap up our conversation. So, Adam, tell us a little bit. Where can we find you online? What kind of linkage or projects do you want to tell folks about if they want to learn more about you?
Well, mostly I'm on the various Criterion Facebook groups. I post there fairly frequently. I also am on Letterboxd. I think my username is Locked Cut on Letterboxd, and I've got a couple viewing projects that I'm just kind of passively addressing. You know, one is I'm trying to rewatch some of the Best Picture winners and review those. And I've always got kind of an ongoing Criterion, you know, Criterions I've watched from the year watch list or review list of various things I've done. I just finally watched all the W.C. Fields short films last week.
Oh, and those were a I lot love of fun. That. I love seeing old yeah. catalog titles make it into people's current day feed. That does my heart well. Yeah, so you yep, enjoy W.C. Fields? That's great.
I thought some of those the shorts were really good. I've seen a few yeah. of his features, never the Bank Dick. That's another one that's on my watch list that I'd like to get to soon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm trying to work through a bunch of the Criterions I've never seen. And, you know, I usually post a review on just about everything I've seen. So you can usually find that all on Letterboxd.
Cool. So. Well, we will have links in the show notes, so look them up and give them your feedback. Adam, it's been a delight having you on board, and we look forward to getting you back on here somewhere down the road. And it's been really fun kind of picking this movie apart with you. You know, my first take was kind of, it's slight, it's forgettable. You could pass it up and not really miss much. But I think upon a second watch and a little bit of reflection, yeah, there's something going on here that is worth pondering. And so I really do appreciate you giving me an hour to talk a little over with you and share with our listeners.
Yep, it's been great.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks a lot, folks. We will be back with Fata Morgana. That's going to be our next episode, one of the Werner Herzog features that recently came up on the Criterion Channel. So I look forward to digging into that one with you, and we will be talking to you soon on episode 59. But thanks for tuning in today. Bye-bye.
Bye.